Now, as you know, there are a number of ways you can tell us what you think of our program. You can send us an email or a letter, or you can post a comment on our website. Well, this may not come as much of a surprise, but people who leave comments on the internet can be really, really, really mean. Blogs and news websites, including ours, have seen more than their fair share of nasty responses and name-calling. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that some sites are reconsidering just how open they really want to be.
If you want to know what it's like to get attacked online, just ask Mikey Shu Levy. She wrote a thankful letter to the editor of the local paper when the health care bill passed. She has lupus. Her 24-year-old son can't get health care because of a pre-existing heart condition, and her husband was diagnosed with liver cancer.
So my thank you note was really about the relief I had mentally.
When Levy looked at the site the morning it was posted, she got comments like this one.
Oh, my poor baby is sick. Only the great Obama can save him. Makes me sick just reading it.
Levy was shocked by the vitriol.
And I'm going, oh my gosh, I can't believe what they're saying. Oh my goodness, this is so personal. I mean, I guess I wrote a personal story, so maybe that's what I asked for.
The Napa Valley Register, which published Levy's letter, wouldn't comment about her experience. But some sites like having personal attacks, says Scott Rosenberg, author of Say Anything, How Blogging Began.
What they really wanted was to boost traffic on their websites because the more pages that are viewed, the more ads can be sold.
Rosenberg says it was just part of the early zeitgeist of the web to let commenters say whatever they wanted.
So many media companies simply opened the doors to their websites and said, anybody come post whatever you want, and expected that they would have brilliant conversations and exchanges of ideas.
There might be a few of those, but too often it's the nasty comments that jump out. Stanford Communications Professor Clifford Nass says it's predictable when you have a lot of people vying for attention.
So ironically and tragically, if you want people to respond to what you say, say something outrageously negative.
And there's been some high-profile negativity on big sites like CNN.com. Lila King, a senior producer there, says during the last presidential election, a commenter kept putting up the same image.
It's a little cartoon of a white stick figure and a black stick figure, and the white stick figure with a machine gun in its hand shooting the other stick figure and its heart exploding and red splatters all over the page.
It isn't just the big sites. It's the little blogs and specialty sites like Religion Dispatches. The site has long-form articles that look at the places where religion and politics meet. Many of the writers are scholars and academics. Editor Lisa Webster says an article written by an expert on Islam got some terrible comments.
Someone from our funder noticed and said, by the way, we're not interested in funding, you know, providing a platform for hate speech.
Webster began to worry that the open comments were detracting from the thoughtful tone of Religion Dispatches.
It's also like old magazine days. You don't, if you're doing a restaurant review, you don't put the restaurant review next to an ad for a garbage dump or something like that. You have to think about these things.
Religion Dispatches has a radical solution. They're getting rid of comments. Readers have to send a letter to the editor. It can be an email, but only a few of the best letters get published.
I think we're going to lose traffic. I'm hoping it'll be sort of a dip. The roller coaster will dip, and then it'll tick back up eventually.
But some sites want to clean up the comments and still maintain a fast-paced response to events. Tom Mallory, the content director for the San Diego Union-Tribune's website, says recently they posted a headline that got his users mad. It was about a man who was murdered by a couple of guys who were spray-painting a wall.
The headline, unfortunately, referred to graffiti artists, which made it seem that they were, you know, Van Gogh with a spray can.
Many users accused the Union-Tribune of having a political agenda.
I waded in, said, it's a good point, I'll fix the headline. Someone asked another question about why it was written, and the readers started kind of answering it and discussing among themselves, accepting my explanation. It was a valuable reader exchange. I'm glad it happened.
Mallory says this helped him see the value of having someone on the staff take part in the conversation. But he says they don't always have the staff available. The Union Tribune is one of many sites that are using technology.
With software, you can ban certain words and phrases, and in fit of piques, as I've done, gone through the site and found every combination of characters that make nasty words and ban those characters, ban those phrases.
Mallory also thinks that anonymity is a problem. The software lets the paper track users, keep a record of their comments, and ban them. According to the makers of the software called Discuss, their 2-year-old product is now being used by 350,000 websites. But Lila King of CNN.com says her commenters have never been anonymous, yet they still had a problem. At CNN.com, they decided the solution is to have a real live person curate the comments and take part in the discussions.
Really, it's the human touch. It's actually staying inside the conversation and being active and highlighting comments that we think editorially are really interesting or significant. Set the tone for what you hope the conversation will be.
If the conversation had been more civil when Mikey Shu Levy sent her a letter about healthcare, she says she wouldn't mind if people had a different point of view.
I think it would be wonderful if we could challenge people who really disagree to have a really great conversation about it. Say a very lively Democrat and a very lively Republican, but really truly be real in what you're discussing.
If all these changes, both technical and personal, raise the level of discussion, many sites are hoping more people will feel comfortable joining in the conversation instead of just watching it explode. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Now, Dickinson, in one of her most famous lines, wrote, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." If she was urging people to be gentle, well, one person who never got her message is American Idol judge Simon Cowell. Here are some highlights of his harsher comments.
"You are the worst singer in America."
"What was that?"
"Terrible."
"That was a copycat performance, not good enough, and you will not win the show."
For the last 9 years, Simon Cowell has built his reputation on, shall we say, honesty, often scathing critiques, but also an ability to pick out and give choice praise to the true stars. Last night was his final show on American Idol.
"I didn't think I was going to be this emotional, but, you know, the show goes forward, it will be different, but I just want to thank you very much indeed. It's been a blast. Thank you."
No one's been named yet to replace Cowell's judge's seat on Idol. His next gig is on a new Fox show called The X Factor. It's an American version of his British talent show. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Occasionally on the program, we have to be the bearers of bad news. And today, we mourn the loss of a cultural image. And you might want to get out your hankies or perhaps cry into your bandanas because the country singer Willie Nelson has cut his trademark braids. Well, Nelson's trim has got us reminiscing about other famous or infamous haircuts, and here to give us a cultural do-tour is Kelly Carter. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you cover pop culture and entertainment for ESPN.com, and you're also a daily columnist for Jet Magazine. And I understand that you've paid a little bit of attention to haircuts good and bad. So I want to break things into two categories, if we can. The haircuts that got us all running to the salon to try to do the same thing,
sure.
And those haircuts that maybe left us scratching our heads thinking, what was he or she thinking? So let's first go to the popular cuts.
Oh, well, sure. I think in the mid-90s, without question, it was Jennifer Aniston. You know, at the time, she was on Friends, which was NBC's big ticket show. And when her character, Rachel, had that cute, long-layered bob, everyone in the country had to get the Rachel haircut. I think when Posh Spice, when Victoria Beckham cut her hair recently, that short, cute bob, other celebrities were actually cutting their hair in very similar styles.
Can a haircut actually hurt a singer or an actor's career? Have we seen that happen?
Yeah, you know, Keri Russell is a really great example. She was on a show, Felicity, that had a really nice following, and then she cut her hair one day. It was long, beautiful, curly locks, and cut it into what people consider to be very librarian, a little outdated. And to this day, you know, she says that people will walk up to her and say, "I really hope that you're growing your hair out." I think for celebrities, you know, hair is part of their silhouette. You know, hair is another character. Hair helps to define how we view, you know, a particular celebrity, musician, actor. So when you go ahead and do something like that, it's definitely going to send up a Google News alert.
Is it possible that you become a victim of your own image, though? I get the sense that maybe Willie Nelson wanted to cut those braids, oh, maybe about 20 years ago, but he couldn't because everyone expected him to have the braids.
You know, definitely. I mean, a lot of times, you know, you have any number of people on your payroll when you're in that kind of position, and they're telling you, you can't cut your hair, you can't cut your afro, you can't unconk your hair if you're James Brown, you know. Whatever the case is, you have to keep that hair a part of your person because that's how people know you and that's what they know you for.
So if you were in the business of managing Willie Nelson's image, how do you handle a moment like this?
Actually, this could be a good thing because when was the last time we were talking about Willie Nelson in a pop culture sense? Cutting his hair may actually be a pretty decent career move for him because all of a sudden people are going to go to the website. People are going to start Google newsing him. So it's going to kind of bring Willie Nelson a little bit into 2010. So this actually could be a good move for him.
Well, Kelly, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Kelly Carter covers pop culture and entertainment for ESPN.com, and she's a daily columnist for Jet Magazine Online.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're like me, you know, when you watch any of these nature TV shows on television and you sit there, don't you wonder to yourself, how did they do that? How did they get that shot? Just as the humpback whale is jumping out of the water? They got it. Or the lion chasing down some sort of prey. They got it. Or how do they get high up in the canopy where those monarch butterflies are and actually get a camera up there to show the butterflies? Well, this hour, I hope to get you some answers from someone who knows. Mike Gunton is the executive producer of the gorgeous 11-part Life series that aired on the BBC and on the Discovery Channel here in the States. All sorts of creatures, or insects and plants included, have their 15 minutes of fame, sort of speak, on screen in the series that documents the struggle for survival. The series is now out on DVD, and Mike Gunton joins us from our NPR West studios. Thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure. Nice to be here.
I know that your specialty are the butterflies, right?
Well, I went on that that shoot because I'm the executive producer. I usually end up spending far too much time in the office. But I did say on this I'm going on that shoot. And I did go on that one, which was great fun.
And we have actually a clip of the making of the Monarch segment on our website at sciencefriday.com if you want to see. Go behind the scenes and see I didn't realize, and this answers the question, how did they get that shot? You have pulleys and ropes and all kinds of stuff to get a camera up and out of the trees on sort of remote control.
It was a pretty ramshackle thing that, you know, a lot of the equipment we have is incredibly sophisticated, incredibly expensive, but this was actually, yeah, pretty ramshackle. It was effectively a cable tied at one end of a tree and tied right up at the top of the other, and a camera hung on a carriage, which had two big bicycle wheels and with lead in the rims to act as gyroscopes. And then a rope goes up to the top of the tree. A big bag of rocks is attached to that, and you just kind of drop the bag of rocks and hope that the weight of it is roughly the same as the camera. And up goes the camera, and it flies through the air and flies amongst the butterflies and gives you that kind of amazing view of what it's like to be a butterfly.
And you did it on the first take, right?
You've seen the making of. Okay. 17th take it was, actually. We didn't get the number of rocks right.
Is that typical?
It can be. So it depends. I mean, of course, in nature, some things just happen the once, and that's you can't ask an animal to go and do a retake. But when you're doing stuff with kit, with weird equipment, that is often when it does tend to go wrong. Because, you know, you're taking stuff out into the middle of nowhere, right, and the humidity and the bumpy ride and the dust, you know, and often this stuff is stuff we put together ourselves with bits of gaffer tape and string.
Right. If you're waiting for like a bug to run by and you don't quite get the shot, do you pick the bug up and put him back in that spot?
I couldn't possibly say. No, I mean, it depends what's happening. I mean, I'm sure that does happen. But, you know, the thing about behavior, this series is very much about trying to get extraordinary animal behavior, things that you see animals doing that you don't normally see them doing. And one of the reasons why we don't do that is because if you interfere with them, they just sit there and go, I'm not going to do that. And so you have to let nature kind of let animals get on with their own lives. Otherwise, they won't do stuff. So we have this kind of rule of a line over which we will tend not to tread. We'd like to get close because we like to get the cameras in their kind of world. But if you step over that line, then they either run away, fly off, or sulk.
And of course, I'm sure you've been asked, what was the most difficult thing? to film in the series?
Well, it depends. I think you mentioned Humpback Whales. We did do a sequence with Humpback Whales, which I think was probably logistically one of the toughest, because anything to do with the sea, anything to do with working in the ocean is always adds that extra. Doing things at night, doing things in caves and doing things in the ocean, I kind of treble the amount of aggro, the difficulty. And this was tough because, for a start, the animals had one thing on their, those male humpbacks had just one thing on their mind, and that was that female that they were chasing. And they, you know, you think of whales as being gentle giants, but these males were completely crazed, sex crazed, and they were swimming five or six times faster than they would normally swim, absolutely going hell for leather after this female. And we wanted to film it from the water level, from a boat. We also wanted to film it from above, because there's a kind of a battle going on. It's basically the biggest bar brawl in nature, because these males are crashing into each other and hitting them with each other with their fins and trying to push each other under and blowing bubbles at each other. And to get the sense of the craziness and the mayhem, we wanted to be right above them in a helicopter shooting down. But we also wanted to get in the water with them and get a sense of what was going on in the undersea world. And that was probably the trickiest, and I'd say the most challenging bit for the crew, even though that's normally the least challenging, because, you know, that's, we do that quite a lot. But it was because the speed they were swimming at and because of their craziness, and the cinematographer, he couldn't use scuba tanks. He could only do it by freediving, holding his breath.
Oh, no kidding.
No, because the bubbles that he produces, because they're so sensitive to the sound of bubbles, because they're using them to threaten each other, the sound of the bubbles coming out of his scuba would have put them off. So that's a good example of what I was saying. And so he had to swim. We zip up in a boat, drop him in the water, takes a deep breath, swims down, takes his shots, pops up to the surface again. We grab him, drop him a bit, you know, so it was a kind of a leapfrogging ahead of him as he was going. And he said it was like standing on a freeway with 10 trucks coming towards him at full speed, and the drivers had their eyes shut whilst he was having to hold his breath.
Wow, playing chicken with humpback whales.
It was exactly that.
Wow. And if you want to see a clip, we have actually on our website at sciencefriday.com, we have a behind-the-scenes clip of making of that whale segment. So we'll go to sciencefriday.com if you want to see it. Did you ever use tiny little cameras? You're in so small spots sometimes filming those insects. Are they tiny cameras, or they just look like you can get in a tiny space with them?
No, they are tiny cameras, actually. And one of the things that the big advances in high definition have really allowed us to step into that miniature world, because, you know, traditionally natural history programs tend to concentrate on the bigger animals.
Right.
And we were very keen to kind of say, well, hold on, if you can actually film the smaller creatures like we would film the big creatures, maybe there's a whole dramatic new world to show people. And that was one of our aims on the series. And you're right, little tiny lenses. Sometimes those lenses, we've even filed the bottom off them so we can actually get them as the camera. Rod Clark, who's one of the cameramen on it, was talking about this yesterday and saying, you know, he tries to get the camera at the eye level of the bug, or sometimes below its knees. So you get that sense you're in its world. And they're tiny little but very sensitive cameras, and so it gives you a nice depth of field, and you really feel that creature is in its environment.
Those little insects, the sequence where the frog his tongue is flashing out to capture the insects.
Yeah, the damsel flies.
Amazing. Yeah. And I love the one where he misses it.
Exactly. I mean, that's, we love that shot, because it just shows, you know, animals don't get it right. And he's so hopeful. He jumps up and he throws his tongue out and he grabs what he thinks is the mayfly. And then he grabs it thin air because he thinks he's caught it. And of course, the damselfly is thrown off and said, ha-ha, escaped you.
For we geeks in the audience, how many frames per second, how fast is that running to get that kind of incredible slow motion on it?
The fastest... One of the big advantages of this new high-definition technology is that we can, in the old days, it was a real struggle to get to these very high frame rates with film. Mm-hmm. But we can now go up to 2,000 frames a second. Now, theoretically, we can go higher than that, but it starts to get quite tricky in terms of actually downloading the data from, because these cameras are not really cameras. They're taking files. They're almost like computers, just like taking zillions of stills and then dumping them onto a big hard drive. So it's not very user-friendly. We have to have lots of wires and stuff when we're doing these kind of shots. But the results are amazing.
And all this is out on DVD now, correct?
Yep. There's two versions of the DVD coming out on this Tuesday coming, June 1st. A standard DVD, you know, and there's also a Blu-ray, which I must say is, I personally think is incredible. I saw the Blu-ray back home, and there was stuff on there that I hadn't seen. I've seen every frame of this series hundreds of times, and I was seeing stuff on that Blu-ray. Well, that I thought, I haven't seen that before. That's amazing.
Well, there are actually two versions of this. There's the your side of the pond version and our side of the pond version.
Oh no, yeah, but there is, effectively there's four versions.
Oh, there's four versions. Like,
because there's a standard DVD, and then there's a Blu-ray.
Right. Well,
DVD.
My point being that you have different narrators. Yeah, Oprah Winfrey is the American version.
Yeah, and then there's also for each of those, there's also a David Attenborough version, which is the version that we did for the airing in the UK, and then there's Oprah's version, which we did for the airing on Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Now, the two things I picked out that I wanted to ask you about. One is in all this nature. 11 different programs, we don't hear the word evolution hardly mentioned anywhere. Was that just for the American audience that you left that out?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, this series is actually all about evolution, but I suppose it's with a small e rather than a big e. What you're seeing is kind of evolution in action, because a lot of this behavior is right at the cutting edge of these animals pushing their boundaries. And, for example, there's a sequence with dolphins where we describe that as cultural evolution. They're inventing a piece of behavior which if it is successful and raises their fitness, then they will that improves their chances, then that behavior will probably get passed on to the next generation and will become part of their behavioral repertoire. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, or if those particular dolphins kind of forget it, then it'll disappear. So evolution, we felt that we were looking at snapshot of evolution happening at these little the shoot tips of the tree of life.
Yeah. And one other little bone to pick, and maybe you'll explain this to me, as a fish myself, when I'm underwater, I never hear any of those watery sounds, the splashing and gurgling that seem to be going on. when your fish are underwater, that's got to be put in later.
Well, we do, but we do record underwater.
Yes.
Of course, but you can't record these things in synchronized, in other words, at the same time. But we do use, we have amazing hydrophones and stuff, and we do record sounds underwater, including, in fact, somebody wrote into us and was rather snootily saying something about we'd stuck some sonar sounds, some submarine sonar sounds over this a seal called a Weddell seal under the water. And it gave me great pleasure to be able to write back to him to say, actually, these are the sounds. The first time anybody's recorded these sounds, we recorded them on a hydrophone. We took these hydrophones all the way to Antarctica. We dug a hole in the ice. We stuck it under the ice and we recorded these sounds. So there.
I got to tell you, I did that in 1979.
What, you went to Antarctica?
Yes. I recorded those amazing Weddell seals.
Oh, you didn't?
Yes, I did.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, maybe it wasn't the first time.
At McMurdo.
That's where we were.
I know, and they were amazing sounds. I couldn't believe seals were making them. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
Mike Gunn is the executive producer of this gorgeous 11-part series, Life. It's out there in DVD and also on Blu-ray. I'm going to get my Blu-ray copy because I'm going to buy one of those and see what it's so pretty to look at. We'll see what Blu-ray looks like. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about the Memorial Day. What is it? Summertime. Well, what is summertime for you? It's all kinds of outdoors things. So we'll start off with talking about birds and their eggs and stuff like that. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.